Tell Somebody this morning, Professor Robert McChesney and John Nichols have a new book out, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Bob McChesney will talk about it.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
www.tellsomebody.us on Twitter at TellSomebodyNow. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on this show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. mail@tellsomebody.us. We'll get to Bob McChesney and Dollarocracy in a minute. But first, the podcast of last week's edition of Tell Somebody with UMKC Economics Department Chair Dr. Stephanie Kelton talking about the economy and responding to a questionable but all too common claim made by a Wall Street economist on NPR's Here and Now. This podcast has been posted. If you missed that show, I really hope you'll give it a listen. Professor Kelton really explains things well. Go to www.tellsomebody.us and click on the tile with her name on it for links to listen to that show or download an MP3 to your computer. You can also subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. I've also just posted a podcast for the July 16th edition of the show with Mike Murphy sitting in while I was away. Mike put on a great show about the protests and arrests recently at the new Kansas City Nuclear Weapons Parts Plant. Click on the tile at tellsomebody.us. Bannister Federal Complex Community Advisory Panel member and ex-Kansas City plant worker Maurice Copeland says there's a meeting coming up. Bannister Federal Weapons Complex workers get important information at the Southeast Community Center, 4201 East 63rd, Kansas City, Missouri, 5 to 8 p.m. on Monday, 12th of August. Dates of coverage requested 1949 to 1993. Again, that's a meeting. If you're a former Kansas City plant worker or interested in the issues that they face, that's next Monday, August 12th, Southeast Community Center in Kansas City, Missouri. If you need more info, send me an email to mail@tellsomebody.us and I'll hook you up. On with the show. Robert McChesney returns to Tell Somebody this morning. McChesney is the Gutzel Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and is the author or editor of 23 books. His work has been translated into 30 languages. He is the co-founder of Free Press, the National Media Reform Organization. In 2008, the Utney Reader listed him among their 50 visionaries who are changing your world. Most recently, he is co-author with The Nation magazine's John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, the book he will discuss on the show today. It has been my position for some time now that corporate personhood and subsequently the need for a constitutional amendment to overturn the Citizens United decision and reform of the media are the two foundational issues that just about everyone needs to concern themselves with if they hope to accomplish any kind of political or economic reform in this country. I asked McChesney about this when I had a chance to sit down with him last April. Here's part of his response.
I think the Citizens United, big money in politics, issue a media firm are not even first cousins. They're joined at the hip. They're Siamese twins. Our book on that, on big money, Dollarocracy, that's coming out, the subtitle is How the Money in Media Election Complex is Destroying America, because media is a huge part of that whole election complex. On one hand, it's media companies that are making a fortune selling these asinine TV ads. And on the other hand, the news media have stopped covering elections altogether, even though that's their primary responsibility in a free society. So we have the sewage flooding us, making these companies rich in the public airways, while we have no coverage of election campaigns to speak of for most elections in this country. Voters are completely without resources when they go into the voting booth to make a decision. So it's a media issue. They're closely related. You can't solve one without solving the other. That's impossible. So I think if we're going to have the sort of reform we need to deal with the crises we face, it will almost certainly have to have constitutional amendments. I just don't. I mean, if we don't, we're just not going to have that period. That's what you're saying. Then he's just saying it's not happening.
I got on the phone with McChesney earlier this week to talk about the new book, Dollarocracy. Give a listen. Robert McChesney, welcome back to Tell Somebody.
My pleasure to be here, Tom.
So, we sat down last April in Denver at the National Conference on Media Reform, and I asked you a question about Citizens United and corporate personhood and the issue of media reform as being two foundational issues that everybody should be concerned with, whatever their other issues. And you mentioned a book that would be out soon. I now have it. It is Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, co-authored with John Nichols. And that kind of answers that question, doesn't it?
Well, that certainly is what we're trying to do, is put the two things together. Our argument in the book, among other things, is that in addition to the flood of money that's come into American elections, especially following Citizens United, but that really culminates a four-decade process, the other side of the coin is that we've seen the news media coverage of political campaigns has both diminished in quantity and has deteriorated in quality, such that the media are really a major factor in the decrepit state of our electoral system.
And just to highlight your take on how serious this is, some of the promotional material with the book talks about the 2012 election as a quantum leap, America's first $10 billion election campaign, solidifying the power of a new class of rich in America, and says that failing a dramatic intervention signals the end of our democracy. It is the world of dollarocracy. The end of our democracy. That's some might call that that liberal journalist and professor going a little over the top.
Well, you know, this is not meant to be a flamboyant or hyperbolic claim. I mean, when we talk about democracy, it's something that has real meaning. It's not a public relations slogan used by Pepsi or some company to sell you junk. And what we mean by democracy is literally, in the Greeks, the rule of the people. And Aristotle understood democracy to mean the rule of the poor. Not that he necessarily approved of it, but he understood what it meant. It meant if everyone was equal in the governance of society, had equal access to power and equal influence formally, that, you know, in a society where the vast majority of people don't have property, they are going to run society. And what the opposite of democracy, or the alternative democracy, was some form of plutocracy or feudalism or monarchy, where those who own the country would rule. And so democracy is a very radical idea, always has been an extraordinarily radical idea. And the history of democracy in the United States has always been a tense battle with our property system, especially what we now call monopoly capitalism, the type of capitalism we have today with huge corporations that dominate. And, you know, I think you can measure the quality of a democracy by how much people without property participate in governance, what role they play, how much influence they actually have. And by Aristotle's, the way he laid it out, 2,500 years ago or 2,400 years ago. And if we use that yardstick, no, we're not much of a democracy. I mean, even at our best, say in the 1960s or 70s, I think America was regarded by political scientists as a weak democracy, meaning that most people didn't really have any control over policies. They didn't know what was going on. They were, the elites tended to really run the country. And that's more so today than even then. Today, even weak democracy is too strong. In the last 2 years, for example, Tom, there were two major studies released in political science that were published by Princeton University Press by different sets of political scientists from Berkeley and Yale and Virginia and other leading universities. And they reached the exact same conclusion, which is that if you look at the actual governance of the United States of America, the influence of poor people, working class people, middle class people, the great bulk of the population on government policies is non-existent. If you look at the core policies in economics, foreign policy, regulation, they are made by and influenced by a very small number of very wealthy institutions and individuals. So in that sense, we aren't a democracy in the Aristotelian sense. In the, if you're using the honest definition of the term, we are what we call in the book a dollarocracy. And that means instead of one person, one vote, it's $1, one vote. Those with the most dollars have the most votes and most control. Now, of course, we still have elections. And on election day, technically, we are all equals. It's the one brief shining moment in the American experience in which everyone truly does have the exact same amount of power. Bill Gates doesn't have any more votes than the person who cleans the latrines at Walmart on the graveyard shift. And that's for that reason, people in power have always detested or feared elections. And for that reason, we see this inordinate amount of attention by wealthy, powerful individuals to try to neuter the ability of elections to put in power governments that might act against their interests because they're scared to death of them. The two great movements we've seen in the last decade on this front have been, one, to increase unlimited, unaccountable corporate and billionaire spending to fund elections, and secondly, to suppress the vote, to keep people who are poor and minority or not considered sufficiently pro-capitalism, pro-right-wing, to make it much harder for them to vote. Because the people who run this country now, the few, the 1%, I think sort of understand that they're not going to win very many elections if the voter turnout rate's over 45, 50, 55%. And they couldn't get elected dog catcher at the voter turnout rates 65, 70, 75% like it is in most other electoral democracies.
But wasn't it ever thus, 3/5 in the Constitution in terms of slaves and women not getting the vote till relatively early in the 20th century? What's so dramatically different now? I mean, I think I've read that at Philadelphia, writing the Constitution, the word democracy was not held in high favor by those in attendance.
Well, our book is not arguing that, everything was just peachy keeny and everyone was just sitting around eating strawberries and whipped cream and living it up with perfect democracy until Citizens United decision. In fact, our book says nothing of that kind or suggests any of that kind, quite the opposite. There's been a tension throughout American history from the very beginning between a very strong democratic impulse, a popular impulse on one hand, and then the strong pressures by those with property and wealth and to limit that and to have them run the ship of state. And I think it's very easy to look at American history and say, well, the bad guys always win. We always lose. But the problem with that theory, if the bad guys always win, how come women are voting today? How do we ever get rid of child labor? How do we ever, have elected members of the U.S. Senate? How do we have labor unions? I mean, if the bad guys always win, how do we get rid of slavery? The bad guys don't always win. They have a lot going for them. A lot of power, and they have a lot of influence, and they have a lot of control, and they're on a winning streak right now. But it's always been a struggle from the beginning of the Republic. One of the things I think that, you know, as a historian, I really picked up on early in my career was when you looked at the people who fought the American Revolution, the actual soldiers, and the people who supported the war, you know, if you were to look back today with sort of this conventional wisdom, it'd be like the people were fighting so that big corporations could run their lives. In fact, if you look at the sermons in the churches of that period and study them, some great work has been done doing that, most soldiers, a significant percentage, probably a majority, the people at the time who supported the war effort, really saw it as a democratic revolution. I mean, they were inspired by Tom Paine, who was by far the most radical figure at the time, and he was, at the time of the American Revolution, Tom Paine was unquestionably one of the three most prominent figures in the American revolutionary effort. And his book, especially Common Sense, was, you know, read by everyone. It inspired the movement. So, you know, there's a tension there, and history's complex, and it's a given force. And what we see in American history is periods when popular forces marshal their forces and have success and win victories, and there are periods when the other side has been victorious. What we argue in the book, Tom, is that in the 1960s and 70s, after several, really 70 years of relatively strong advances in many respects by popular forces in America, to the point where we had less inequality by 1970 than had existed in America since probably before the Civil War, when we had, we had a really dramatically changing country, that at that moment, by the early 1970s, the conservatives, business, corporations were really freaked out. They thought they'd lost control of this country. Middle-class kids who were sort of the bastion of conservatism in every other country in the world and had been in the United States before the 1960s and 70s were suddenly a bunch of socialists, were very critical of corporations, didn't like big business, were critical of commercial values. And so starting in the 70s, we see a concerted, aggressive, and extraordinary campaign to reassert corporate and 1% domination of American politics. And that's what we talk about at length in the book, because that explains the moment we're in now, that explains Citizens United, that explains really a lot of what's taking place in our politics.
Yeah, now, you know, I've been doing this show since, I think, fall of 2005, and from day one, I was talking media reform, and nearly from day one, I would occasionally talk about the concept of corporate person. I had Tom Hartman on several times talking about Supreme Court cases years before Citizens United. One thing I wasn't particularly familiar with was in your chapter on the architects of some of what you're talking about, Lewis Powell, Supreme Court Justice, and the Powell memo. This was just fascinating and a little frightening. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I'd be glad to. Yeah, you know, and John and I did a lot of research on this for the book, but I want to say that other people have done work concurrently or even before us, so we're by no means claiming that we broke the story of Lewis Powell. Lewis Powell is probably well known to a lot of listeners as a member of the U.S. Supreme Court for around 15 years, from the early 70s to the mid 80s. And he was a very distinguished lawyer, corporate lawyer in Virginia, very wealthy. His primary clients over his career were the tobacco companies of Virginia, who he represented ably. And he was a Southern Democrat. He was considered a moderate, and that's because in American politics, whether you're a moderate or a conservative, then and now was determined, you know, by, well, then especially by whether you were, like, used the N-word in public or something. He was a moderate only in a very strange sense, because he was one of the most vulgar, strident corporate champions ever, and detester of labor. So he was, but in the public, the way he's presented is this kindly old Southern gentleman who's moderate. And I guess he's probably moderate on some issues, but certainly nothing to do with class power, corporate power, labor unions, the role of money in government. And Lewis Powell, before he joined the Supreme Court, had looked around at America of the late 60s and early 70s, and he saw a world in which Ralph Nader was a folk hero across the political spectrum. when young people and African Americans and women were all playing a much larger role in public life than they traditionally played, and were making demands on the system that never been made on the system before, where the idea of everyone getting a great education was seen as like a realistic expectation, not pie in the sky. And in this whole world, Lewis Powell freaked out. He said, this isn't going to work. Business, which is the traditional ruler of America, does not have a standard place. We've got to change this. And he wrote what's called the famous Powell Memo now, and people can find it by Googling Powell Memo online. It's posted. It was only 6 or 7 pages long. But it was a memo he wrote for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce saying, in effect, look, corporations are losing the battle for power in this country, and we're in the process of the country moving well away from corporations dominating, and in fact, we might become obsolete, and the solution is going to be corporations organizing politically as never before to take over the country and to run the government again. That's what we have to get. And he laid out briefly a blueprint for taking over universities, dramatically increasing lobbying in Washington by corporations, taking over the media, in effect, though, multi-front war to dominate the United States by wealthy people and corporations. And why it's gotten so much attention recently and why it's so striking is that when you read it, it's basically everything that took place in the following 30 years almost seems like it came directly out of this playbook, out of this blueprint. The number of corporate lobbyists mushroomed dramatically. The right wing took over the court system with people like Lewis Powell put on the Supreme Court. And basically ushered in a whole new era of radical changes in how the Constitution was interpreted, so you could have unlimited money in campaigns, and your states could now, again, suppress the vote, even racially, in a manner that was not considered constitutional or legal prior to that. So it ushered in this era. You know, there were lots of other things. I wouldn't say if Lewis Powell hadn't written the memo that all this stuff still wouldn't have happened. But it was striking just how much clear class consciousness there was that was behind the commanding heights of what we now know as this whole right-wing movement, featuring groups like ALEC and the Koch brothers and all those, the Federalist Society and all those PR firms and think tanks in Washington, culminating in things like Fox News and basically the entire Republican Party.
Yes, and also in your chapter on architects like Powell, another main subject is Chief Justice Roberts. And I remember, I think, after the Citizens United case had been heard, but well before the decision had been handed down, I had somebody on with Public Citizen explaining how this was a real activist decision. He had taken this Citizens United versus FEC case and had it re-argued and expanded it in a way that had little to do with the original Citizens United court case, because this was a deliberate attempt to, you know, whether he was consciously following the Powell memo or that's just the way he felt. This was not just deciding a case in the way that we normally think of it, was it?
No, you got it exactly right. In fact, you know, in doing this book, what became clear to me was that it was only about 100 years ago that most Americans developed any respect for the judiciary. You know, in the progressive era in the late 19th century, a lot of Americans thought all judges were crooks, that they were basically there to work for powerful interests, and, you know, you'd never get a fair shake in a court. And it was one of the great victories of the first 7 decades of the 20th century that most Americans thought, you know, the courts weren't perfect, but they believed in the rule of law, and they were actually going to play by the rules and enforce it, and they weren't going to be heavily partisan in their conduct, both at the federal and local level. And I think that when you look at Roberts, you can understand how people felt 100 years ago when they looked at these hack judges on the Supreme Court and other courts who were just pushing their political agenda, then dressing it up with whatever legal niceties they can to end up where they, end up where they wanted to end up in the first place. And Roberts is a perfect product of the Lewis Powell experiment. Powell said, what we need to do is cultivate a farm club of Supreme Court justices who are going to be stridently pro-business, develop them and get them on the Supreme Court so we can own the court. And if we do that, we'll win everything. We'll win most everything. And they've done that since the 70s. It used to be, and I know you probably remember this, Tom, that Republican presidents would appoint members of the Supreme Court, going back to people like Earl Warren or Harry Blackmun, and they would get on the court and they would, you know, evolve into being fairly liberal members of the court. And it could work the other way, too. Democrats could appoint people to evolve and be conservatives. There was sort of a sense that you put good people in there and you sort of, you know, let them be great judges. That was the 20th century model. And, you know, the Powell memo says, screw that stuff. We can't take chances. We've got to put these Scalias, Alitos, Clarence Thomas's types in that we know are going to be on our side. They've been trained. They're going to always come up with the decision that suits our needs. There won't be any chance they'll go Earl Warren on us and become liberals. And Roberts is the perfect example of that. He's a political hack. He was someone who's hardcore, super right-wing dude. And politically, he was the three issues you knew the day he came into court, he'd already written the opinions to, because they were, he was going to get these things through. One was he was going to have unlimited money, private, anonymous, whatever, money to flood our elections, hence Citizens United. And hence, when Citizens United came along, you knew that, like he did, he was going to go back and rewrite, you get the facts he wanted so he could write the opinion he'd already written, which was going to get rid of any limits on corporate and billionaire spending and effectively allow anonymous spending. Secondly, you knew he was going to make it possible for states to suppress poor people voting. He knew that was mission critical for right-wing politics, so they can't win a fair election. He knows that. That's why Citizens United there. And so that voting rights issue that came down a month or so back, there was a surprise to no one. That was a given he would deliver the goods there. And third, every labor, you know, he's going to do everything in his power to eliminate organized labor as a force in our country. Not just because he wants lower wages for workers, which I'm sure he's happy about, and business stuff, but also because organized labor is the only institutional force that has the resources to stand up to corporate power. So when they neuter organized labor, they leave the bulk of the population relatively unorganized and defenseless against a very organized corporate community. So John Roberts, on those issues, he's written the opinions before he got in the court. He cooks up whatever legal doctrine he needs to push his political agenda, his radical agenda. This has nothing to do with the Constitution whatsoever. A lot of this stuff, like Citizens United, Voting Rights Act decisions, these are things he's just pushing his political agenda. And what the right wing does successfully is they project. You know, when they accuse the other side of something, like remember they accused Acorn of rigging elections, and they accuse the liberals and the Supreme Court of trying to legislate, you know, create laws on their own, usurp the power of the legislative branch. Basically, they're just talking about what they're doing. They're just trying to deflect. They're projecting because they don't really see that's exactly what they're doing. I mean, he's, like, radically, single-handedly changed stuff that, you know, 100 years of state legislatures had always unanimously been on the other side on these issues. He single-handedly said, no, I've now decided the Constitution says you can't do that. It's absurd, it's crazy, it's obscene. There's a special place in hell for John Roberts, but he is dollarocracy's bag man. He's exactly what the system wants, exactly what they got. And one other point on that, John Roberts is not a moron. You know, he's dogmatic, doctrinaire, vulgar. He's anything but a moron. He understands that to win the key things that are crucially important, like being able to suppress the ability of blacks to vote, being able to let billionaires buy elections, you know, he's going to have to basically give on other issues. So I wasn't surprised about that health care issue about Obamacare a couple of years back. I wasn't surprised about the gay rights issue. I think on issues like that, he understands if he throws a couple crumbs out there and gets people talking about that, he can get away with what really counts, which is reifying class power and eliminating democracy in any effective sense of the term.
Yeah. This is Tom Clammer. We're talking to Professor Robert McChesney, co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And you devote a good amount of space in the book for talking about public broadcasting, its history and how it was originally conceived, and with much or most of the credit going to LBJ, who by some accounts you could consider a crooked politician who controlled media in Texas to get where he was and effectively tried to monopolize that, I guess. And this is the guy that pushes this vision of public broadcasting that's a little different than what we see it as today. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I think the place to start is that, you know, last election was a $10 billion election for all the races in the United States, which you chronicle in the book. And it might have been a little bit more than 10, but 10 that we can be pretty confident about. So much of the money now is this dark money that is run through the Cayman Islands and isn't reported. It's really difficult to get an accurate figure. So almost all the numbers you see are going to be off, and they're going to be off by underestimating the actual amount being spent. So it's a $10 billion election. Well, most of that money goes to pay for television ads. That's the lingua franca. That's where the money goes. And most of the television ads are negative ads. We go into great detail in the book about that. And the reason why this relates to public broadcasting is that you don't have television advertising play much of a role in any other country in the world. This is really a distinct television campaign advertising, political ads. This is a distinct American phenomenon for the most part. And the reason is that we have this huge industry of commercial broadcasting that owns the policymaking, that makes a killing. They're just making absolute fortune from these political ads. And they have strong incentive in maintaining this system because it's such a source of profits for them. And in other countries, the reason you don't have political ads is that they almost all the other democracies have really strong public broadcasting systems where all candidates get airtime, where there are lots of debates, where there's coverage, and where political advertising is actually illegal. Candidates aren't allowed to purchase ads on commercial stations in most countries, including Britain, which is probably the nearest to us. You know, they understand that these ads are obscene and absurd. So, you know, the United States never has had a public broadcasting system with the sort of resources and command like these other nations. And I mean, I've written about that elsewhere in a little bit in this book. What was striking to us, though, as we did this, as we did the research for Dollarocracy, was that when money on television ads really started to explode in 1960, and explode might seem like a funny term to use because in real terms, factoring inflation, the amount spent on TV advertising in 1960 political campaigns was maybe 1 or 2% of what was spent this last year. But people thought it was outrageous then how much was being spent. And politicians in both parties saw this was completely changing the nature of politics in America, that if television advertising was going to take over everything, it was going to require raising much larger amounts of money than political campaigns had to ever raise before. And from the 1960s, there were some serious efforts to try to restructure American campaigns. These lasted in the 70s, so they could make them not reliant on large donors. They could have just funded by small donors. And one of the other great efforts was to set up a real public broadcasting system that would give lots of coverage to candidates and to politics so that Americans would have some place to go on their television dial and broadcasting to learn about politics aside from political ads. And in the 1960s, one of the great motivations for creating public broadcasting in the U.S. Was to enhance political campaigns and, you know, to make it possible for candidates to speak to voters, there to be debates, not in the guise of commercials, but an actual conversation and sober discussion. And that failed. I won't keep people in suspense about the outcome. But we were struck with how, what a nerve had struck then with so many Americans, what a great idea they thought it was at the time.
You know, with all this talk about these $10 billion campaign and all this television advertising, a lot of us feel like we're too smart to be influenced by that. And you write a lot about the effectiveness of this television advertising and much of it in terms of oligopoly and comparing it to commercial advertising, the similarities and differences. Can you define oligopoly and flesh out some of what I mentioned. Well, there.
Yeah, I mean, oligopoly simply refers to what's the dominant form of industrial structure in the United States, which means it's not a pure monopoly where one company sells everything, but it's not a competitive market where there are, you know, dozens of players and newcomers can enter profitable industries, the kind you hear about in textbooks and the kind that politicians talk about. Most of our major markets are all oligopolies. Two, three, four, five companies dominate it. It's almost impossible for newcomers to enter markets, and they tend to be quite profitable. The 200 largest companies in America today have a larger share of GDP than I've ever had in American history. It's grown appreciably in the last 30 years, and there's no reason to think it won't continue to grow because these guys own the government, and they're going to make sure they can continue to benefit by it. So that's oligopoly. Now, the point you started with, Tom, which I think is really important when we talk about it at length in the book, is the idea that, look, you know, we're flooded with these asinine political ads on the airwaves for months and months and months before elections. Some states are worse than others. Missouri, I suspect, has it worse than Kansas, since Kansas is a one-party state. But even down ticket ballots, we get a lot of stuff. In the primaries, we get a lot of stuff. So everywhere, all Americans are flooded with these inane ads. And most Americans say these ads are stupid. They're a complete waste of money. No one I know pays attention to them. I hate them. I pay no attention to them. They can't have any effect. They're going to eventually go away when people wake up and realize no one cares about these stupid ads. And then the question is logically, well, why are all these people spending $6 billion on these ads if, in fact, every American you ask about them says they have no influence on them and they are of no value? Wouldn't you think that the rich people who own this country are smarter with their money than just to torch $6 billion? And the fact of the matter is these ads are extremely effective, and there's two things you have to know about them, these TV ads. First of all, a political marketplace, a political race, is very different than a commercial marketplace. In the case of Pepsi and Coke, you know, there's two cola drinks, basically, that share the market, but divide it up. If Pepsi gets 49.8% of the cola market and Coke gets 50.2%, Pepsi is still an incredibly lucrative company. It makes killer profits, billions and billions of dollars a quarter, tens of billions a year, possibly. But in a political campaign, if the candidate getting 49.8% in a two-party race, they've lost everything. They're out of business. They're completely broke. And the one that gets 50.2% wins everything. It's winner-take-all. So advertising is crucial, not basically so you get, you know, if all it does is get you over 50%, even if it costs a fortune, you win everything. So it's hard to overspend when you look at all the stakes to get over 50%. That's why you spend so much, even if 90% of the people who look at the ads won't respond to them. It doesn't really matter if they know who they're going to vote for. It doesn't affect them. As long as it affects the relevant 10%, that's the way you reach them. Secondly, research shows, interestingly enough, they'll do focus groups. I'm doing this for a few years, including the 2012 election. They'll do focus groups with voters. And invariably, when they get people around the table to talk about campaign ads during the election season, voters will always say, oh, these ads are horrible. I don't like them. They have no influence on me. I don't pay any attention to them. Maybe I do the opposite, just I'm so angry at them. They're terrible. And then they will do focus groups with the exact same people after the election. They'll ask them who they voted for and who they didn't vote for. And when they ask for the reasons why people voted against someone, they invariably are repeating word for word what they came through in a negative ad. They say they don't listen to negative ads, but don't believe it. They do work. They especially work in an environment where there's no journalism. So, you know, you have nothing except the negative ads. The only information you're really getting about a candidate is the negative ad or the candidate being attacked responding to the negative ad. So, of course, they work. And that's why people spend money on them.
And you just mentioned in an environment where there's no journalism, you and Nichols, your previous book with John Nichols, about the death of journalism.
Yeah.
You spoke a lot about that. I don't seem to be hearing as much about newspapers folding and laying off reporters as I was a couple of years ago. What is that environment since your previous book, and how does all of that fit into this current work?
Well, we are news. I think, in fact, we've seen in the last 3 years a continued deterioration of the economy of commercial journalism. There have still been massive layoffs. Just last week or the week before, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, I think, laid off a third of its staff. Earlier this year, the Chicago Tribune eliminated all its photographers, and basically the handful of remaining reporters who just use their smartphones to shoot pictures for stories. So, I think that almost across the board, the situation has deteriorated since 2010. There are far fewer journalists. Most election races, as a result, get no coverage whatsoever, zero. So most of the things someone goes to vote for on the ballot, they have no news media support to help them make sense of it. Or the coverage is so superficial as to be worthless. I mean, you know, just so-and-so will speak tonight at the courthouse. That's not really helping you. And so at that level, it's dreadful. I mean, the fundamental reason we have freedom of the press in our Constitution, why the press is such an important part of our system, when from the very beginning of the Republic, it was understood that we could have meaningful elections without a news media. That elections without a news media are a joke. They can't be functional. And that's where we are now. At the same time, there still is a lot of news, and there still is a lot of campaign coverage. But it's really gravitated to the worst possible coverage. It's horse race coverage, primarily of the presidential race, which receives an inordinate amount of inane attention. And this horse race coverage is basically, reporting on the spin that each campaign uses, reporting on polls, reporting on who's ahead and who's behind. And the big issues are whether or not the BS any candidate A is trying to use is being believed by the public. And if the candidate can get people to believe his BS, then he's a smart candidate and he's doing a good job. And if your BS isn't working, you're a bad candidate. But the fact that it's BS doesn't really factor in. There's not a lot of time to really examine the content of the message and get dig into let voters know exactly what's going on with the content of the message. So the journalism is nutritionless for the most part. It's pretty much vacuous. Most of what passes for campaign journalism in American news media would have fit comfortably in an authoritarian society. You know, could have had the Bulgarian Politburo could have been covered that way because there's just little meaningful content to it. And invariably it comes down to what's horse race journalism. The candidate is ahead in the polls, gets good coverage because they're seen as working the system well. The candidate behind in the polls gets negative coverage because they're behind, and so there must be something wrong with them. It's dreadful, to be honest.
And a $10 billion election, and you write that most of this money is going to television. They should be flush with cash to hire big investigative journalism staff and raise the level of TV journalism to fill some of the gap left with dying newspapers. Why isn't that happening?
Well, I assume that's a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
The answer is self-evident. It isn't happening because they're out to make as much money as possible. So broadcast journalism has been just as emaciated and emasculated as has been print journalism. And, you know, there's no money going into covering campaigns from all these profits. Quite the contrary, there's going into the shareholders, the corporate coffers. The journalism is a joke on commercial television. States today. These industries, local television stations that are all owned for the most part by a handful of big conglomerates, they are to campaign finance, you know, what the NRA is to gun control. They basically benefit by this flood of money. And even though no one says it explicitly, doing a lot of journalism would just undermine the need for political advertising. The less journalism they do, the more money they're going to make. So I think it doesn't take a genius to figure out there's no real reason to cover these campaigns when you can get a fortune selling ads on your airways. And that's exactly what has taken place and is taking place. It's really corrupt. I mean, it's hard not to study this place as I had and see the cynicism. You know, to give one example, Tom, of how this works, the political ads for candidates on television are protected by the First Amendment. That means a TV station has to run the ad no matter what it says. They can't say that's a lie. You are allowed to run that. They just have to run it as a candidate. They've got a First Amendment right to say what they want to say. That's not true for commercial advertisers. A TV station can't run an ad for a used car dealer if it knows that the used car dealer is lying. It has an obligation to stand by and vouch for the quality of its ads. And if a commercial television station is seen running a bunch of ads for products that are bogus, it by law should lose its license when it comes up for renewal. It has an obligation to make sure viewers of television have a right to know, think that the station is vetting its commercial ads so you're not getting conned and ripped off. Well, a lot of the ads that post Citizens United are what are these dark money super PAC third party ads that aren't connected to the campaigns. They're independent expenditures. These ads are supposed to be, not just theoretically, but legally, are supposed to be regulated just like commercial ads. So they're not connected to campaigns. They're supposed to be held by the stations accountable for their factual accuracy. And these are the worst ads by far of the campaign because they're almost all negative ads. They're unaccountable. So you can say anything you want, and the campaign can deny it has any connection to the ads because it's done by an independent group. And we studied this pretty closely. You had not a single one of these ads was ever rejected by a commercial station because it was fraudulent or bogus. The Federal Communications Commission explicitly decided not to enforce that rule. Thought it would be too controversial if they told stations to start enforcing it. So they just looked the other way. You had a situation during the 2012 campaign where a couple of stations actually had news teams that would study bogus political ads and evaluate them that would rate these ads, these third-party ads, as being nothing but lies, the lowest possible rating of credibility, to say they're completely fraudulent. Yet the same station that the newscast is on will continue to air these fraudulent ads for weeks and weeks, hundreds of times, since they're making so much money. That's how corrupt and cynical the system has become.
This book was, of course, completed before the NSA and Edward Snowden thing blew up, but I couldn't help noticing Glenn Greenwald being quoted several times, not related to that, but you have one subheading, Data Uber Alles. And one of the things with this NSA business that struck me that the Greenwald stories have sort of brought to light, but that isn't being discussed much, is the privatization of data gathering and revolving door of intelligence professionals in government and private firms and Facebook and Google and all of this cooperation in those quarters. And do you have any thoughts on your data Uber Alles and some of what's going on there?
Well, you've opened up a huge can of worms, considering we've got about a minute left before we have to close. And I can't do justice to that question. I wrote a whole book that relates to that called Digital Disconnect that came out in March, and we've already talked about that, I think. So I don't want to avoid the question, but I will say, Tom, is that the second to last chapter in Dollarocracy is about digital campaigns. It's about how the Internet is changing elections. And where it relates to NSA is very simple. I think for a long time, people thought the Internet would free us from lame political ads. It would give us the information we need. It would sway the ability of the rich to buy elections. And what we saw in the 2012 election was that this whole model of using the Internet for surveillance and then carefully monitoring everyone to give them specific messages for candidates that they would like to hear just for them was really developed into a high science and art form by the Obama campaign, and now the Republicans have already announced they're going to outdo the Democrats by the 2014 election cycle with their own surveillance of voters. And it very much relates to the sort of information the NSA gets, and it very much relates to the issue of how there are huge private corporate monopolies like Google, Facebook, Yahoo, Amazon, and the like, that they're all part of this, providing the data for candidates to do this. And so, yeah, it is closely connected on that note.
Well, as you noted, we are just about out of time. I've been talking to Robert McChesney, co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. If you can do it in that short a time with all the cynicism that this a lot of what we talked about might stimulate, you still seem a little optimistic about fighting it, and a big thing is still voting, right?
Well, why is it that the corporate right is trying to make it possible to buy elections for billionaires? Why are they making it legal for southern states to basically suppress the vote? Why is this going to, the reason it's happening is that these guys know they're losing. They actually don't have the numbers to win a fair election, so they can't have fair elections. They know their policies aren't working. They know the great bulk of Americans wouldn't put up with this stuff if they had a decent political system. We've got the numbers on our side, more than we've ever had in my lifetime. We've never had the numbers on our side like we presently do. The great crisis of our times is that our political system is so corrupt and bought off it can't accurately reflect the will of the people. And that's what we have to work on. But that just means we will win if we organize. We've got the numbers. I mean, I've been in far worse moments. 1980s, I didn't think I had the numbers. Now I do. So it looks grim because the other side is taking these aggressive steps. But they're taking these aggressive steps because ultimately they're in a position of weakness.
Okay, we've left out a lot. You're going to have to go to the book to find it. Robert McChesney, thank you very much for taking the time with us today on Tell Somebody.
Pleasure, Tom, and good luck with the show.
Robert McChesney, co-author of Dollarocracy. As I noted in the introduction, he has written or edited 23 books, several of them, like this one, with John Nichols. But McChesney says of Dollarocracy, quote, "It is the most important book of our careers." U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders wrote the book's foreword. With this book, he writes, John Nichols and Bob McChesney invite Americans to examine the challenges facing America in new ways and to fully recognize the threat that the combination of big money and big media poses to the promise of self-government. They paint a daunting picture, rich in detail, based on intense reporting and groundbreaking research. Former FCC Commissioner Michael Kopp says, Dollarocracy gets at what's ailing America better than any other diagnosis I've encountered, plus it presents a cure. What else could a reader or a citizen ask for? To me, it's the book of the year. Close quote. Before we close, I bring you a public service announcement from the NSA. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.